Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a Fresno man who still carries shrapnel in his hip. 70 years ago, a plane he wasn't even supposed to be on was shot down by the enemy.
Your whole life flashes in front of you. You've heard that. That happens.
Literally.
It happens.
Find out how he survived that fiery crash in England and how he saved the lives of others on board. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done things, who have endured things that are really hard to imagine, and that is certainly the case today with Niall Smith. The point of this program is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we are educated, we're entertained, and we're certainly inspired by these stories from members of our greatest generation. Our guest today, 91-year-old Niall Smith of Fresno, California, originally from the Decatur, Illinois area. He's a recipient of the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, and the Soldier's Medal. Very interesting story behind the events that led to a couple of those medals, and we're going to get to that. But let's start a little earlier on, Niall. Growing up in rural Illinois, you said Decatur was the closest town. That tells me that you were out in the country somewhere?
Yeah, it was a small town called La Place, Illinois. And I was raised on a farm. Me and my dad were a farmer.
What'd you guys grow?
Corn, soybeans, wheat, clover for cows and everything.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Six brothers, no sisters.
Well, that's a lot of hands on the farm then.
Yeah. Of course, they're not all at the same time, but there's over three or four boys there to help do the farming and the work.
So it sounds like that occupied a lot of your time then growing up.
Yeah, it sure did. As far as the cows were concerned, you or animals, you got to be there 7 days a week. Somebody has to be there to feed them and take care of them and all that.
So as you're going through high school and all that, were you dreaming of getting off the farm at some point and going somewhere else?
Not really. I was going to go to college. I graduated from high school in 1940. And I had a scholarship to a college in Carthage, Illinois. But then the war came along, so that was that.
Yeah, you had just celebrated your 19th birthday about a month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were when you found out about that?
Yes. You never forget a thing like that. Well, we were in a lay place there in the farmhouse in a dining room. It was about, or when we heard about it, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was sitting there listening to the radio. My dad was over in the corner in the rocking chair asleep, and the announcement came on. The Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. All military personnel, if you're on leave or wherever you are, get back to your bases immediately. So I woke my dad up and told him, what? He couldn't believe it, see?
Did that hit you like a ton of bricks? Was that a pretty big deal?
Well, it's hard to believe. It was hard to believe, you know. So then I went into service in January of 42.
So you weren't waiting around to get drafted. You said, I want to do something?
Well, I didn't want to be in the Army, really, because, you know, they had a lot of time on the ground and everything. So either the Air Force or the Navy. So I enlisted in the Air Force.
How many of your brothers ended up serving in the war?
Okay, two others during the war. Altogether, there were five of us brothers that had been in the service.
Wow.
Four of us have retired from the service.
How many years were you in?
22 years, 20 2 months and 6 days.
Not too many veterans I get to interview who served in both World War II and the Vietnam War, but that's the case for Niall. We're going to hear about that. And you mentioned the other brothers that were in World War II. Did they make it home as well?
Yeah, everybody made it home.
You had quite the odds to beat to make it home yourself. We're going to get to that. But let's talk about those early days in the Army Air Corps. Did you go in hoping that you could become a pilot? Because most guys that did something in the Army Air Corps say they wanted to be pilots.
Yeah, I wanted to be a pilot, but you got to, at that time, you got to have education.
Mm-hmm.
I think now it's 4 years, but at that time it was 2 years. So I knew I couldn't be a pilot. So I said, well, I'll be a gunner or something like that, be on an air crew. At the time I applied, that was all filled up, so I couldn't get that. So I ended up being a mechanic. I went to mechanic school.
Mm-hmm. Little did you know what was ahead of you. Little did you know some of the adventures you would have, the close calls you would have. That it wasn't just medals you brought home from the war. You brought home something that's lasted a lot longer and been a lot more important to you. We'll get to that before we're done. But when you say a mechanic in the Army Air Corps, what did that mean you were responsible for, and how much responsibility did you feel?
Well, you went to aircraft mechanics school on a B-17. Well, of course, we didn't know what kind of planes we were going to be or working on or assigned to. Then, well, we found out it was going to be B-17s. There was about five men on a ground crew. There's always a crew chief, assistant crew chief, and then two or three other guys. You start out just ground crew, but I ended up being assistant crew chief. Of course, that takes several years to get up to that. But it's B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
And our group was formed, the 96 Bomb Group was formed in Walla Walla, Washington. And our commander at that time was R.J.J. Olds. He was a colonel. He was later on, after the war and everything, he was in charge of 15th Air Force at March Air Force Base. He was a general, some kind of general.
And from going on the farm with your brothers to at these different bases with all these guys from all over the country, was that a bit of an eye-opener for you?
Oh, yeah. Started out in Walla Walla, Washington, was there a month. Rapid City, South Dakota for a month. Pocatello, Idaho for 2 months, I think. And then we got on a train and we went clear down around through California and everything to Paoli, Texas. And that base was built, or just finished building it. And we were there about 3.5 months, and they were continuing the training to go overseas. We didn't know where we'd go, but ended up being England.
And I want to talk to you about getting over to England and about what you brought back from England. But the B-17, to be responsible for it operating the way it needs to, I mean, you've got men's lives in your hands every time that plane goes up, don't
you? That's right. Been some nights we worked all night to make sure it's right or, you know, get something done so that they could have the plane for the next day.
Was there part of that? When you go through all your checks and make sure this is operating right and this is moving right and that's running right, was there one part of that that gave you the most trouble or that was the hardest to make sure it was doing what it was supposed to do?
Well, probably the hardest thing was getting there, like when you changed an engine and then you've got to put all the accessories like carburetor and fuel pump and everything else on the new engine, transfer that over and then hang the thing. And getting adjusted to the right RPM and, make sure that everything is working like it's supposed to work.
Because if it's not, that could cost some people their lives.
Well, that's right. That engine could quit or go out.
So was that fulfilling work for you?
Well, it was at the time, you know. I mean, sure. You just made sure you did the job right. I remember during the war, like in England, lots of nights we were working nighttime. We didn't have big floodlights and everything else. There's a war going on. We use flashlights. You hear a plane overhead, you turn the light out. Because they said that a plane from 10,000 feet can see a cigarette on the ground.
Wow. Sounds pretty tense.
Yeah, lots of night.
What about the journey over to England? Was that an adventure for you?
Oh, yeah. We got on the train at Paoli up through Fort Worth and Dallas. And at that time, the space between Dallas and Fort Worth, there might have been 20 miles or so. No people. But now it's all one big city. Anyway, then we went up to New York, and we left from Pier 50 on the Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. And right beside where the Queen Elizabeth was, here was the Normandy lying on its side. Somebody had sabotaged it, and it burned.
That's encouraging.
So, yeah. So then we got on the ship, and it took us 6 days to go across. They changed course every 7 minutes, zigzag. And mm-hmm. The only people that knew the course was the captain and the navigator. They did that because of the subs. 15,000, 18,000 troops on that one ship. 24 hours in the stateroom, 24 hours on deck. A stateroom that would normally have maybe two or three, four people, here's maybe 18 people assigned to that one room, about four high, you know. I know the first night I went out, had to go out on deck, it started raining. So what do you do then? You pick up all your stuff and go and get out of the lounge someplace.
Do you remember what it felt like emotionally? I mean, were you concerned that you might not see America again?
Well, not really. You know, young people, they're full of energy and they don't think about things like that. They just want to get in the middle of everything and they don't think about dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't think about it until it actually happens or, you know, something happens and you think you might.
And before you went over there, did you think that your job was going to be a pretty safe job, comparatively speaking?
Well, yeah, but England was getting bombed too, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the first night we were in England, our base got bombed.
Wow. Welcome to the war.
And we hadn't had any, we didn't have any shelters or anything else when anything set up as a new base, see? Here was guys diving through hedges to be in a ditch, get in a ditch, stuff like that.
Where'd you go?
I just found a low spot and got in it. But there wasn't anybody killed or anything.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how old were you?
Well, I'd be 20, I guess, 19 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So then your bombers start flying their missions. And tell us what your duty was like those first few weeks and months that you were over there.
Well, we had to get them ready. If they came back, either bomb damage or engine out, something like that, we'd change an engine overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take maybe 6-8 hours. And we heard that the Germans could change an engine in 15 minutes. They had all quick disconnects and everything else. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We had hoses and clamps and, you know, all kind of stuff. Anyway, you just keep them ready. And they always called, or they said they need so many planes. We got to have so many planes. So there's lots of times we worked all night, you know, to get one ready. Even changing outer wing panels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How did the pilots and the crews of those bombers treat you?
They treated us good, and they depended on us, too. Like the original pilots that we took over there, I mean, they knew what was going on, and they knew that, or they depended on us, and they got to know the ground crew and all that, because you can't have a plane, something happening on the flight. So, yeah, they appreciated it.
And you mentioned having to fix damaged engines or patch up damaged planes. Was that a pretty frequent occurrence? I mean, was it rare for a group of bombers to come back unscathed?
It was rare for them to, very rare for them to come back unscathed until about, it had to be in 44 before the P-51s got over there to where they could go all the way on the mission.
As escort, yeah?
Right, as escort. Up to that time, they could only go halfway, like a P-47, they go halfway and they have to turn around. Then you're at the mercy, and here's a German fighter sitting out there waiting, see? So when they came back, there was holes. Of course, you had sheet metal men. That was their job. There was holes. There was half a tail shot off, you know, and stuff like that. So there was lots of damage, and we knew that that's how it would be. It would fly it almost.
Did you ever look at a plane and say, I don't know how that one made it back?
Yeah, yeah. We had one. It wasn't our plane. Let's see. Part of the tail was gone. Two engines were out. The third one was going out. So actually, he only had about one engine, one and a half engine. And he made it back. And when it landed, the gear gave out, and he just slid, you know. I don't know how they made it back. There were six guys wounded, and they shot several fighters down. See, that plane had to leave the formation. Something was wrong. They had to leave the formation and come back on their own. And, of course, here are these fighters. They jumped right on them. And the pilot, they said if it hadn't been for the pilot, they wouldn't have made it because he would twist that plane around so that they'd have to line up on a tail or something. And he twisted sideways so everybody could get a shot at him.
Wow.
But there were six guys wounded and maybe one killed. But anyway, They made it back. I don't know how.
And you said that wasn't one of your planes, so it makes me wonder, how many planes were you and your crew responsible for?
Well, we were just responsible for the one plane.
Our plane, yeah. So you had the same pilot and crew to deal with for quite a while until they went back
to
the States?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the original crews, we got to know pretty well, you know. By the time they rotated or were gone, well, then you get new crews. You remember a plane called $5,000?
Uh-huh.
That was on our base. We got that plane.
All right.
One mission. It lasted one mission.
Right. It was called $5,000, of course, because it was the 5,000th B-17 that Boeing had produced since Pearl Harbor. And they had a huge celebration around that plane as it left the plant in the Seattle area. If you were alive back then in May of 1944, maybe you even heard about it in a war bond drive or a newsreel somewhere. And I do have a photo of $5,000 up on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page, so you'll see what I'm talking about. It had 35,000 signatures on it from all the people who had worked on one part or another of that milestone bomber. In fact, they said all those signatures actually added drag to the aircraft and slowed it down in the skies. And as Niall alluded to, $5,000 didn't get off to the best start at the 96th Bomb Group base in Snetterton, England. It had to make a crash landing. But after that, after it was repaired, $5,000 did go on to fly 78 missions with another bomb group. It's a pretty fascinating and multifaceted story about that particular B-17, $5,000. And I do have some links to that story online at hometownheroesradio.com. And you know, Niall Smith's story has some parallels. Before he ever saw all those signatures on $5,000, he had survived a crash a whole lot worse than what that famous plane endured. But what was a mechanic doing up in the air? What brought the plane down in the middle of the night? What did Niall do that earned him the highest honor a soldier can receive for an act of valor in a non-combat situation? And is that really the medal he should have received? We're going to explore some of those questions and more with 91-year-old Niall Smith when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 91-year-old Niall Smith, a veteran of both World War II and the Vietnam War, retiring after more than 22 years in the Air Force. He grew up on a farm near LaPlace, Illinois, about 20 miles east of Decatur. For nearly 40 years now, he's called Fresno, California home. But it's pretty remarkable that he survived one treacherous night more than 70 years ago. The photos we've posted on hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page will help illustrate why I say that. But before we get into that fateful night, one more question about his work as a mechanic on B-17s at that base in Snetterton, England, home to the 96th Bomb Group during World War II. Niall, you talked about having to fix those planes after they came in so heavily damaged. Sometimes you couldn't even believe they'd made it back. And I know there are also times they didn't make it back. What would that do to you emotionally when you and the rest of your ground crew realized that one of those 10-man crews was not coming back? Their plane had been shot down.
Oh, yeah. Well, you thought about it and everything like that, but you didn't really have time to grieve or anything else because here you got a new crew and you got to keep them going, you know. So you just keep on doing your job.
And how often did your job mean actually going in an airplane and flying with these guys?
We weren't part of the air crew, but I did go on a couple of missions just to see how they were. You know how young guys are. One was a food mission when they dropped moved to the Dutch, and the other was an actual mission. But we made it back. I mean, I don't know why I did that. When I think about that now, I was stupid, you know, when I didn't have to go.
Where were you during the mission? What part of the plane did
I was,
you?
I was back in the waist. Uh-huh. Back in the waist where the waist gunners are, yeah.
Did you see some exciting action?
Oh, yeah. You see them out there just like Memphis Belle, you know, or same kind of deal. And you mm-hmm. see things happening. I mean, planes going down, everything else, yeah.
And in April of 1944 came an incident that I don't see how you couldn't say it changed your life. It's the reason you have the Purple Heart. It's the reason you have that Soldier's Medal I mentioned, and I'll read the citation about that in a little bit. But tell me how that all came to be, because you weren't initially supposed to be on that plane, right?
No, it was another crew, and I don't know what the other ground man or on the other crew, what reason he couldn't go for some reason, and he asked for somebody to volunteer, so I volunteered.
Don't you know you're never supposed to volunteer in the service?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
That's what everybody tells me anyway.
But
what do you think possessed you to volunteer?
Well, I knew this other guy pretty well. He's kind of a buddy, you know, and just doing it for him.
And what were you supposed to do?
Well, the two ground men went with the plane the night before. See, our squadron was all what they call pathfinders. They took the ball turret out of the bottom and put a radar dome in there, and then they led other missions because they could bomb through the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to furnish planes to other groups to lead the other groups. And two ground men always had to go with the crew in the plane to the other base, and then we'd see the plane off the next morning.
So they needed you there because you knew these specific custom planes with the radar domes, and then you would have to check them out and make sure they were flight worthy before other group would take it up?
As far as the plane, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, see the plane off.
Yep.
And then we'd get a ride back to our base somehow.
So how long of a journey was this from your base to this other base?
Oh, about 30, 40 minutes.
30, 40 minutes, nighttime?
Yeah, nighttime.
No big deal.
It's close to midnight. It's right at midnight.
And did you know the Germans had night fighters?
Oh, yeah. We used to go outside, at nighttime, watch the searchlights. And I know this one night, here's a whole bunch of searchlights that had... They were on this one plane, and all at once the lights went out, and then right behind where that plane was, here's a bunch of tracer bullets. So they set up for a British fighter to get on. Yeah, every night we'd see that, every night.
So you knew there was a chance this could be, even though it's a short flight, that this could be dangerous.
Yeah, but we never really thought about it, mm-hmm. you know, just going to the other base. That was at a low altitude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this other base was right on the coast. And this German, he must have been out there off the coast waiting for somebody to come around on the pattern, and then he followed us around.
Yeah, so tell me how you experienced it.
Okay, we was on the final approach, and under the pilot, he'd turn on the landing lights, put the flaps down, and we were slowing down, and we were maybe a couple hundred feet off the ground, and all at once I hear firing, or hear bullets, you know. And I thought the British were shooting at us from the ground with anti-aircraft fire, that maybe a little instrument they call the indicator friend or foe wasn't working. And then I looked out the side window and I saw the tracers going by. Every fifth bullet is a tracer. And I knew what it was then. I said, oh, God, you know. And I burrowed. There's a bunch of baggage back there in the waist. I was in the waist. I burrowed my way down to the bottom of that, and that's probably what saved me.
So you knew as soon as you saw those tracers that guys were going to get hit and this wasn't going to be a smooth landing.
Right. I knew we were going down, yeah.
Wow.
And the man beside me, the bombardier, he was back there asleep. I mean, missing just to another base in England, see, and he stood up, what's going on? And then a bullet hit him, see, and I got a little piece of it, but...
Where'd it get you?
In the hip. A piece of it got me in the hip. And then it was hit, because I could feel it. I could feel the blood going down my leg.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you get shot with a bullet, it doesn't hurt. It's hot.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot. That piece of metal is hot.
I want to get and I know you're going to give us a great description of this, but I'm just thinking everybody listening has never been in this circumstance. Maybe we have a few veterans who got shot down, but even that's a little different. I mean, you're coming in for a landing, not expecting this, and all of a sudden this chaotic scene ensues. So was this something that it felt like slow motion?
Yeah.
Did you have things come to mind that you didn't expect to come to mind? What was that like for you?
Well, you've heard that when you're – well, I thought this was it, see. You're facing death. I think, well, like, tell yourself this is it. And your whole life flashes in front of you. You've heard that. That happens.
Literally.
It happens because things came to my mind when I was a little kid that I hadn't even thought about. And then the crash, you know, but it happened.
And were there other people – trying to duck for cover, screaming? Did they not have time? I mean, did you hear anything on the intercom?
No, there was nothing on the intercom. There wasn't a sound in that plane. Everybody knew what was going to happen. Of course, it was dark. I couldn't see what the people up front were doing or anything else. There wasn't time to really do anything because we hit this row of trees, and all I remember is hitting the ground and this crash or sliding or whatever, and for several minutes, I guess, and then everything stopped, you know, and so, I was still alive.
So you're conscious this whole time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I might have been knocked out for maybe an instant or so. When everything stopped, I looked around for the back door, and it wasn't there. No back door.
And before it stopped, are you bracing? You clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Just waiting. I was just waiting for, you know, what was going to happen, or wondering what's going to happen.
And you've believed for 70 years that the plane just slid along the ground, and I just showed you an eyewitness account from that I found on the internet where people say the plane actually cartwheeled, went end over end. With what you remember, does it seem like maybe that could have happened?
I wasn't aware of that, but it might have happened.
Because you can't see anything.
No,
you're just feeling
it
chaos,
was dark,
right?
Right, yeah. And the plane broke in two.
Mm-hmm.
So that could very well have happened. That was news to me.
So when the plane stops, you look for the back door. It's not there.
That's right.
What happens next?
I turned around, and it's broken in two, so I crawled out through a bunch of wreckage, the part that was open where it broke in two. And I got outside, back to the tail, and here's the other ground man, this Sergeant Matthews. He was laying there moaning, groaning. He was talking about some girl down in London, I think. And I didn't know that. I heard later that he had a broken back. I don't know if he did or not. But I saw all the flesh from his thumb. His thumb was clear back against his wrist.
Mm.
So I took hold of his parachute harness, and I dragged him. He was bigger than me. I dragged him maybe 150 feet, got behind the brick wall, and then I went back to the plane. There was two or three other guys there, and
The plane's burning at this point?
Oh, yeah, it was burning more all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was going to blow up. I knew that because I'd seen them blow up, you know.
Sure. So you grabbed some more guys.
Yeah, we got the pilot out. The pilot was clear back in the waist. The co-pilot, he said he went through the top. And when he came to, he had a bump on his head, and he was hanging in a tree, still strapped in his seat.
Talk about a sight you don't expect to see.
Yeah. The engineer on the plane, he was trapped down in the wreckage someplace, and he had to take his pants off to get out. He had a finger cut off. He got out. The radio man, we never did find him. We couldn't find him. Of course, the bombardier was shot, and the navigator, we found him, or he said he was in the wheel well behind number two engine, up in there somewhere. But we got everybody out, and we got him behind this brick wall, and this maybe took 15, 20 minutes or so. And of course, the plane's burning more all the time, and we were just waiting, see, there wasn't anything else we could do. And all at once, that thing exploded. And we had 1,700 gallons of octane fuel.
Yeah, because this, was a short flight, but
yeah,
a fully loaded plane, fuel-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh.
We had four 500-pound bombs on it, two smoke bombs for the radar part of it the next day, and about 20,000 rounds of 50 caliber ammunition on there. And of course, when it blew up, everything went up in the air, everything, maybe 100 feet, 150 feet. And the gasoline was burning and it arched over, and I thought it was going to fall on us. And I got up and started to run again, but it burned out before it got to the ground. Mm. So it must have been half an hour. Of course, this was off the edge of the base. See, we didn't make the runway. About a half an hour, here come an officer from the tower in a Jeep. He was in Jeep. And the first thing he asked, he said, "Where's the parachute harnesses?" Because the gunners or the flight crew, they carried a little medical kit strapped to their parachute harness. It had morphine and everything in it. So he started giving morphine to the people that were injured, or, you know, and I never even thought about that, you know, but then it must have been another hour or so before any ambulances ever got out there. And three or four ambulances come out, and they took us into, wasn't a hospital, it was just a dispensary, and they didn't do anything to us that night. I guess they looked us over and everything and washed your face and hands and stuff like that. And I'd lost my favorite cap. But anyway,
burned up in the plane?
I don't know what happened to it. It came off somewhere.
And when you said you never found the navigator, is your guess that his body was burned in that explosion and fire?
No, the radio operator.
Oh, I mean the radio operator.
Yeah.
You think?
Well, he was down in the wreckage someplace.
Yeah.
We couldn't find him.
But so then when the explosion happened,
he'd go up. And the next day they took us up to a general hospital, and I was there 2 weeks and went back to base.
How much pain were you in?
I wasn't in any pain then. I was bruised and everything all over, and I still got a little piece of that bullet back there in my hip yet. I didn't know that was there until a few years ago when I had an x-ray from my back. The doctor says, "Hey, you got a piece of metal in your hip back there." I didn't know that.
It's been there a while.
Yeah. Anyway, the pilot called me, had me come up to his, where he was in the hospital there, and he thanked me for saving his life. Hmm. Because he'd come through the back from the cockpit, back through the bomb bay, through the radio room, and he was back in the waist, and we took him out. Yeah. He said that was his first night landing in a B-17.
Wow.
And get shot down.
And you said 2 weeks later you're back on the base. A lot of those guys were wounded to the point that they got sent home, but you had to keep on serving over there.
Yeah, I had to. And, well, I had to stay. And I went down to the base hospital to see the doctor because I thought, well, maybe I can get back to the States. And I started telling him how I was having these bad dreams and everything else about it. And I couldn't do my work, you know, and that kind of stuff. And he looked at me and he said, "Nothing wrong with you. Get back to work."
Hmm.
So that didn't work.
Well, maybe it's a good thing because had you met a special young lady named Phyllis yet?
No, I hadn't met her yet.
Well?
But you know, after I was back to the base, they made me, after a week or so, they made me get in another plane and go up. They said, if you don't, you won't want to fly again. You don't want to get in any airplane. So I didn't. And after that, it was all right. But it didn't bother me anymore.
So we hear all this now about PTSD. And basically, that was their approach to dealing with your post-traumatic stress and these flashbacks you were having.
Yeah.
Wow. But it worked for you.
Yeah.
Well, we're thankful for that. And I know you're thankful you weren't sent home right then because there were a few more developments that proved to be very important. It's break time, and I'd again like to encourage you to hop on hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and look at those photos from the B-17 crash that Niall Smith survived. I think when you look at those, you're going to be pretty amazed that he did survive. And we'll get the rest of this 91-year-old World War II veteran story when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Reminder, you still have the rest of this month to go online and enter our contest to win 4 free tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood. All the details are online at hometownheroesradio.com. If you've looked at the photos there of the B-17 crash from April 12, 1944, you might find it hard to believe anyone survived that crash, but Nile Smith did. So did 8 other men, and it was a surge of adrenaline that helped Nile rescue some of those other airmen and pull them to safety. He was even able to lift a heavy radar dome weighing hundreds of pounds that had pinned one of the men to the ground. Before we left off, I mentioned a young lady named Phyllis. So let's get that story of how you met her, Nile.
About every 10 days on the base there, we get a 2-day pass and go down to London, like 2 or 3 of us go together. And that's what we did all during the war. But then the V-2s started coming in, the rockets.
Yeah.
They go up about 50 miles, and then they come straight down. And there's no warning or
right.
anything else.
You don't hear the putt, putt, putt.
Well, that was the buzz bomb, that yeah. putt, putt. But I was in London. This was, I guess it would be about August or something, August. One of those rockets hit about a block away from where I was. I was on the sidewalk, and the concussion threw me back against a brick wall, and I was off the ground about a foot, and I couldn't move.
Holy moly.
And there was people out in the street there that it killed. So I said to myself, this is the last time I'm going to London. I'm going someplace else, because I'm not dealing with these V-2s. So then I went up and started going to Scotland. They're going, you know, and that's how I met my wife.
Well, tell me the story. I mean, it's a lot to go through to have to meet your wife, you know, surviving this horrible plane crash when you're shot down and then almost getting killed by a V-2, and that's what it takes to send you her direction, huh?
I guess so.
How'd you meet her?
Well, about September of 44, I started going to Scotland. That's 400 miles from where the base was, and it's not like the train is now. The train does, I think, in about 4 hours. But you had to ride all night on that train from England to Edinburgh. And if there's an air raid, they'd stop train, turn mm-hmm. everything off. So it was all night journey up there. So I started going up there. And I don't know if it's the first visit or the second visit. Like every 2 weeks, we get time off. I went down to this, they call it the Palais de Danse. It was a big ballroom. And I saw her standing up there. And she was up on, I think, a balcony, and I kept looking at her, and I don't know if she was looking at me or not. Anyway, I went up and asked her to dance, and that's how we met.
And you'll have your 70th anniversary this December.
That's right, December 30th.
How about that?
Yeah.
You must have decided pretty quickly then that she was the one, because you guys got married while you were still over there. The war wasn't even over yet.
That's right. We got married in December. Yeah, it was quick. And we could only see each other every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah, so much for a honeymoon, right?
Yeah, we didn't have much of a honeymoon. Yeah, we went back down to where the base was, and I think we were in Norwich one night.
So how much longer were you over there?
Well, I was over there until the war ended May the 8th, 45. There's a story about that, too.
Let's hear it.
Okay, the day before, I had a buddy that worked up in personnel, and he came down and saw me. He says, hey, the war is going to be over tomorrow. I'm married by then, see. If you want a pass and you want to get out of here, you get your pass and get out, because they're throwing a restriction on the base. Nobody gets on or off when the announcement is made. So I got my pass, and Phyllis and I were sitting in the theater in Edinburgh when Churchill came on the screen and announced the war was over.
Huh.
And here's all these other guys back at the base.
Was there a big cheer in the theater when that announcement was made?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't tell anybody what I knew or anything, see, but I think people kind of knew it was going to happen.
Getting close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there any concern on your part that you might be sent to the Pacific?
I was supposed to be going to the Pacific.
What happened?
Well, see, the war was over. Then I don't know actually what happened to our outfit, but I had so many points. They had started a point system,
mm-hmm.
and because of... maybe my medal had something to do with it. But I had enough points that I'd get sent back early to the state. But I didn't have the orders, but I was told that I was going to be assigned to the 20th bomb group or whatever it was, the B-29s in the Pacific, and to go out there. But I came back in August of 45 and got a 30-day leave. And while I was on leave, while the war ended, so I didn't have to go. So then I got out then.
Was that a pretty big relief to you to know that the world was no longer at war?
Yeah, I didn't have to go. Didn't have to go to the Pacific because I didn't want to go to the Pacific. You'd go, but I didn't want to go.
Well, you had a wife to worry about now, too.
Yeah.
What was it like to be back home in America and to be introducing your war bride to all your family and friends?
It's something to start with, and then you just kind of get used to it. Everybody, you know, gets used to it. She didn't come right away, but she came in March of 46 before she came.
Uh-huh.
And she came on the Queen Mary.
Huh.
The first Queen Mary.
Uh-huh.
And here's, I don't know how many thousands of war brides up there. We stayed in New York for several months. And an aunt in New York until we went to Illinois.
You know, so many people today don't know that much about World War II. It's so long ago now, and maybe people don't appreciate what the world was like or what it took to win that war. When you think about it, what gives you the most pride or the most satisfaction about what you did and all those other guys you knew did?
We did a job we had to do. I'd do it again, just like Vietnam. I didn't want to go to Vietnam because that was a war zone too. But I went, and here's all other people trying to get out of it. But I went. You do your duty, you know. You go.
What'd you do over there?
I was first sergeant. This was a transport squadron. We had the planes, and many carried supplies back and forth. And I was at Cameron Bay. The Viet Cong tried to get in there. One night, they almost got clear in. They had three perimeters of defense around every base. And on the last defense, they had their dogs out there, see, police dogs. And they got clear into almost inside the Viet Cong, I'm talking about, before they killed them. I wasn't in the fighting or anything, but the Marines and the Army were there. Another fellow and me, we were up there looking at some of the Viet Cong that they'd killed, and this guy beside us, hell, I know that guy. He's one of the barbers in the barber shop here.
Wow.
So
that gets your attention. And was that any different for you, knowing that you had a wife and daughter back home while you were in Vietnam?
You think about it, but you don't worry about it. Something could happen. I mean, it could even happen on the way or on the way back or something, but or any place.
I've got a few more questions for you, and if there's anything I didn't touch on, I want to hear about it. But I'm just reflecting on that day in April of 1944 when this crash happens. And I guess the one thing, before I read your citation and ask you a couple other things, I'm just thinking about it, and I'm thinking of everyone at home listening, and they're saying, he wasn't supposed to be on this plane. He volunteers. He's on it. It almost claims his life. It did kill three others and severely wound all these other guys. He doesn't get to come home. He has to stay over there. If he doesn't, he's never going to meet his wife. His daughter's never going to be born. His three grandkids and five great-grandkids aren't going to be here.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible story. How do you make sense of all that? What do you credit for the way it all happened?
That's just the way the world is, I guess. Strange things happen all the time, or things happen you don't expect to happen, but that's the way it goes.
Is it something that you just say, well, that's luck, or do you think there was somebody up there pulling the strings for you, or what do you think?
I think there was that night. Yeah. It wasn't my time to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You mentioned the pilot coming to you in the hospital and thanking you for saving his life. So there were all these other survivors. There were, what, I guess 9 survivors and 3 killed. Did you ever, after the war and all the years past, have any contact with any of those other guys?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
I wonder if any of the rest of them are still living.
I don't know.
Maybe we can find that out.
There's not too many left anymore, you know.
That's the reason we do this show. Exactly. So we can know these stories. And I'm so grateful for you sharing it. Let me read this. This is what the government said about Sergeant, at that time, Corporal Niall Smith of the Army Air Forces. For heroism not in action against the enemy, displayed at a bomber base in England, 12 April 1944, when the plane in which Sergeant Smith was flying crashed into a field, 3 crew members were killed and 9 others, including Sergeant Smith, were injured. Despite his painful injuries and the imminent danger of the plane exploding, Sergeant Smith helped the co-pilot remove the pilot and other injured crew members. The plane blew up shortly afterwards. The bravery and utter disregard for personal safety displayed by Sergeant Smith on this occasion helped save the lives of the injured officers and men. His actions reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. And they awarded you the Soldier's Medal. Hearing that, thinking back to that, what does that mean to you, that they recognized what you did was something special?
Well, that means a lot. I mean, you know, it's just something that, you did your job and you did what you could. And I think most of the guys in the service were that way, too. Even when you read stories about Afghanistan or Iraq, wherever, you have a bunch of buddies, you know, and you're all for each other. You're protecting each other.
Amen. And the one thing that jumped out at me as I read this, and I'm sure you don't pull this out every week and look at it, but the first sentence there, they say, for heroism, not in action against the enemy. Well, your mission wasn't against the enemy, but it was an enemy plane that shot you down.
That's right.
I wonder if they re-examined this, if they'd say something different. And I showed you, too, something else that I found. There's a record of the German pilot who shot you down, and he was the same age as you, 21, shot down 4 Allied planes within a 2-week span and then died in a mid-air collision about 2 weeks after he shot you guys down. What's that like, to know the other side and to hear about this man who almost ended your life?
That's something that's hard to believe. You know, if you'd have met him someplace or somebody you could have known, you know.
Sure.
I mean, he was doing his job. It's like you've heard stories about the two pilots, I don't know, it was American or British pilot and German pilot. They were going back from England to France, and they crossed each other or passed each other, and both of them were out of ammunition.
Right.
And they waved each other. Yeah.
So there wasn't a whole lot of animosity on your part, necessarily.
No. No, he's doing his job. That's just like the flight crews. I mean, here you are, you're in a bomber, and you know that the bombs you're dropping, there's going to be civilians killed and everything else. And the flight crew, I've heard them talking. They say, well, that's just something we have to do. That's our job.
Mm-hmm. And the 3 men that died in the crash that could have claimed your life, did you know any of them at all, or were they complete strangers to you because you had just volunteered?
Well, they were all strangers to me because that was another crew.
Yeah.
I just volunteered to help this other crew, this guy or a buddy. I took his place. So I didn't actually know him.
And you mentioned right in the immediate aftermath how you did have some of those flashbacks and the dreams about it. Have you had any problems with that in all the years since?
No, not really, no.
Have you ever caught yourself thinking about it and saying, man, that could have been me? I could have been one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you think about it once in a while.
Where does that lead you?
Well, it doesn't lead me anywhere. I never expected to live this long.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You're looking good.
Well, yeah, but there are things that keep going happening. Can't live forever.
No. Well, Niall, I just want to say thank you for serving our country for those, what'd you say, 22 years? How many days?
2 months and 6 days. You never forget that either.
No, and I know the Air Force thanked you. But thank you for serving. Thank you for telling us this story that no one else could tell us. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know about you and all those other Americans who served in World War II?
Well, not really.
What's the secret to a 70-year marriage?
You just get along with each other is all I know.
You make that choice, huh?
Yeah.
Were there any other incidents or occasions I didn't ask you about that you wanted to share?
Well, there was one time in Vietnam. See, I'd gone from our base down to Tonts Newt. That's the base center near where I think they call it Ho Chi Minh City now or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'd caught a ride down there. I had to do something down there. I don't remember what it was. Coordinate some stuff. And I was catching a ride back. And I got a ride on a C-130 back to Cameron while we were on the plane, getting ready to taxi out and everything. Every cargo plane has what they call a loadmaster. He goes around and checks all the pallets
right. And
the straps and everything, holding them down, so make sure nothing moves during flight. He was going around checking, and he went by this one pallet, and he saw this thing kind of sticking out. It was a hand grenade, and the pin was out of it.
Holy cow.
The slightest, it wouldn't take too much movement for that thing to fall out of there and, you know, blow up, and it could have brought the plane down. But so then everybody got off, and it took them, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour, to check that plane everywhere, wheel wells up in the wing, make sure there was nothing else there before we left. We got back on the plane and went back to Cameron, but you never know, you know.
You've been through it. You've got some close calls. Somebody has been looking out for you.
And the day we came back from Tontanut, I mean, they weren't leaving from our base, but we went down to this main base. And the day before I went down there, the Viet Cong had bombed the front of the passenger terminal. Mm-hmm. The whole front of it was gone.
Timing is everything.
And that same, when I got down there, well, it was the next day I got down there, we were sitting there waiting on the plane. I look over to another table. Here's Robert Mitchum sitting over there.
Uh-huh.
He'd been over there making some kind of a movie.
How about that?
I still got his autograph in there.
Oh, yeah?
But I went over and introduced myself. That's her autograph. Says, how you doing, Bob? He said, oh, okay, Smitty. Could I have your autograph? Sure. He scribbled the thing out.
That's funny.
Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, there's some good stories about Robert Mitchum doing some very generous things for the troops in Vietnam. And then when he came back to the States, he advocated for America's mission there and told America that the forces should not pull out of that situation. That was in 1966. And of course, Mitchum was, like Nile, a World War II veteran. He had served in the Army for the final months of the war. That was after he'd finished filming The Story of G.I. Joe, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. That World War II drama was inspired by the writings of the late war correspondent Ernie Pyle. And you can even find that whole film, The Story of G.I. Joe, online at sites like YouTube. HometownHeroesRadio.com is where you want to go to see some photos of our guest today, Nile Smith. They're also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Don't forget to enter that contest to win 4 tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood as we gear up for another World War II-based movie, Unbroken, Louis Zamperini's story, coming out at Christmas time. We're going to be back next week with the story of a World War II medic wounded in the Pacific. Until then, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.